We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Paul Marzello. I am the president and CEO of the Buffalo and Erie County Naval and Military Park. With great pleasure, we are bringing a special rendition of our Pearl Harbor Remembrance. We'll have a little bit more information on that as the program continues, but we're going to start, as we always do, with the posting of the colors. Color guard will be presented by Charles Andrews and John Radens. Please stand as we present the colors. Gentlemen, present the colors. The singing of our national anthem will be done by Mr. George Miller.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight. Oh, the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof to the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Color guard dismiss. Please remain standing while I call forth Fred Fritz Marazita, who will lead us in prayer.
Thank you, Paul. As we assemble this morning to remember Pearl Harbor, we guard in our hearts the sacred memory of those who gave their lives on that day, which will live in infamy. Bless us, O Lord, as we humble ourselves in thy presence to remember our shipmates and friends who served our country so valiantly. May we never forget that more than 2,000 of our sons, fathers, brothers, and friends were killed, and more than 1,000 citizens of our land were wounded on December 7th, 1941. Their sacrifices were not in vain. They defended America's freedom and demonstrated America's goodness. Help us remember the survivors and remaining service members from the greatest generation who depend upon us to keep alive the memory of their fallen comrades. Let us not disgrace those who perished through our indifference or forgetfulness. Rather, help us to always remember Pearl Harbor and help us keep America safe. We pray for peace. We pray for those deployed and in harm's way even as we gather, protect them. We pray for those in secure areas that we feel are out of harm's way, keep them alert. Ever remind us that the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. For the sake of the generations, let us pass on the hard truth that we could claim victory from tragedy only if we do not allow history to repeat itself. Let us ever see that Pearl Harbor energized a generation, the greatest generation, to look within, step up, risk everything, and humbly walk away. Guide us and direct us in all that we do. Let us live to bring glory and honor to thee. Amen.
Please be seated. At this time, we'll have a wreath laying. Wreath laying will be presented by Mr. Peter Gullill, U.S. Navy. I feel blessed this morning that we have bookends, for me at least. I have our youngest of generations and I have our oldest of generation. I'm going to ask that we acknowledge the students from Akron High School. Please give a shout, raise your hand so we can see where you are. Thank you for coming this morning. On the other hand, we are blessed to have a World War II veteran. We don't normally get this opportunity to honor in person, but we have a very special guest, Dr. John Long. Would you please stand up for the Big Red, World War II veteran. And this special program that we have developed today, there's probably very few people in the room who can honestly say that they remember those events firsthand. Well, Dr. Long will be one of them. For the students that are here, I hope you take in as much information as you can today, because this was a life-changing event for not just Americans, but for the world. So please learn, listen, remember, and I'm going to introduce our Director of Programming and Community Engagement for this next segment of the program, Courtney Speckman.
Good morning. Pearl Harbor had a direct impact on Americans across the country, regardless of whether they were called to action in World War II later on or supported the war efforts at home. President Franklin Roosevelt, who we are going to learn a little bit more about this morning, was having lunch at the White House when he got the news about the attack at Pearl Harbor. Throughout the afternoon, he met with aides and monitored the crisis. Shortly before 5 p.m., he began preparing a war message for Congress. Though drafted in haste, FDR's words the following day would inspire the nation. First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt addressed the American people before her husband did. Her weekly radio program, called Over Our Coffee Cups, was already scheduled to go out that Sunday, and she kept the schedule that evening, adding a few words of commentary on the news to the introduction to the program that she had planned. According to the FDR Library, she became the first public figure to speak to the country about what had happened. At 6:45 p.m. on her live program, Mrs. Roosevelt said the following. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am speaking to you tonight at a very serious moment in our history. The cabinet is convening, and the leaders in Congress are meeting with the president. The State Department and Army and Navy officials have been with the president all afternoon. In fact, the Japanese ambassador was talking to the president at the very time that Japan's airships were bombing our citizens in Hawaii and the Philippines and sinking one of our transports loaded with lumber on its way to Hawaii. By tomorrow morning, the members of Congress will have a full report and be ready for action. In the meantime, we the people are already prepared for action. For months now, the knowledge that something of this kind might happen has been hanging over our heads, and yet it seemed impossible to believe, impossible to drop the everyday things of life and feel that there was only one thing which was important, preparation to meet an enemy no matter where he struck. That is all over now, and there is no more uncertainty. We know what we have to face, and we know that we are ready to face it. I should like to say just a word to the women in the country tonight. I have a boy at sea, on a destroyer. For all I know, he may be on his way to the Pacific. Two of my children are in coast cities on the Pacific. Many of you all over the country have boys in the services who will now be called upon to go into action. You have friends and families in what has suddenly become a danger zone. You cannot escape anxiety. You cannot escape a clutch of fear at your heart. And yet I hope that the certainty of what we will have to meet will make you rise above these fears. We must go about our daily business more determined than ever to do the ordinary things as well as we can, and when we find a way to do anything more in our communities to help others, to build morale, to give a feeling of security, we must do it. Whatever is asked of us, I am sure we can accomplish it. We are the free and unconquerable people of the United States of America. To the young people of the nation, I must speak a word tonight. You are going to have a great opportunity. There will be high moments in which your strength and your ability will be tested. I have faith in you. I feel as though I was standing upon a rock, and that rock is my faith in my fellow citizens. On the following day, on December 8th, President Roosevelt went before Congress to report on the attack and ask for a declaration of war. He also wired British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and said, "Today, all of us are in the same boat, and it is a ship which will not and cannot be sunk." So before I go into his presentation anymore, I would like to introduce our speaker today, Albert McFadden, who is joining us to help reflect on President Franklin Roosevelt's life and presidency and his response to the attacks on Pearl Harbor. For over 20 years, Albert has been researching and portraying the 32nd President of the United States, which began with a production of Annie at the Lancaster Opera House in the late 1990s. Originally from Niagara Falls, he has performed at numerous schools and theaters across the country, and he supplied President Roosevelt's voice in the Ken Burns production, The National Parks, America's Best Idea. Please stand and join me in welcoming President Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Thank you. You may be seated. On January 6th, 1941, I said the following in my State of the Union address. And at that time, the war had been raging in Europe since 1939, September of 1939. This speech, and I won't read it all because I might put you to sleep, was known as the Four Freedoms speech, and I meant every word that it says. The immediate need right now in this country is for a swift and driving increase in armament productions to meet the hazards from the Nazis and possibly the Japanese. We should plan a better system by which persons deserving or needing gainful employment may obtain it, hopefully in the armaments industry. In the future days in which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human foundations. The first is the freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is the freedom of every person to worship God in his own way, everywhere in the world. The third is a freedom from want, which translated into world terms means economic understandings, which all will secure in every nation a healthy peacetime life for its inhabitants. The fourth is the freedom from fear, which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armaments to such a point and through a thorough fashion so that no nation again will ever take up arms against any other nation. Freedom means the supremacy of human rights everywhere. Our support goes to those who struggle to gain those rights and to keep them. Our strength is our unity of purpose. To this high concept, there can be no anything else but victory. Thank you. In that year, war seemed to be coming closer and closer. But also in the year 1941, I had run for president again. And I beat the Republican from Kansas, Wendell Willkie. I received my third term as president. I received 449 electoral votes, and Landon got 82. We beat him. I sat down with the cabinet and General George Marshall, and we discussed world events. The magic code intercepts, we had broken the Japanese consular code, indicated something big was about to happen. Spy activity in Hawaii and even in the United States was up. We expected Hong Kong, Singapore, and possibly our own Philippines to be hit by the Japanese. By executive order, I prohibited the selling and shipping of scrap metal and oil to Japan. We were not going to send them metal to make bullets and bombs to kill our people. Japanese Ambassador Nomura and his assistant, Mr. Karushu, were scheduled to have an urgent meeting with our Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, at 2 p.m. on Sunday, December 7th, 1941. You know, it's a beautiful day here in Washington, D.C. on December 7th, 1941. And you know what I'd like to do is to listen to the radio. Let's see what we can get on the radio. Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate and the House of Representatives. Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, seeking to foment the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Indeed, 1 hour after the Japanese air squadrons had commenced bombing in the American island of Oahu, the Japanese ambassador to the United States and his colleague delivered to our Secretary of State a formal reply to a recent American message. And while this reply stated that it seemed useless to continue the existing diplomatic negotiations, it contained no threat or hint of war or of armed attack. It will be recorded that the distance of Hawaii from Japan makes it obvious that this attack was deliberately planned many days or even weeks ago. During the intervening time, the Japanese government has deliberately sought to deceive the United States by false statements and expressions of hope for continued peace. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. Yesterday, the Japanese government also launched an attack against Malaya. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Hong Kong. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Guam. Last night, Japanese forces attacked the Philippine Islands. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Wake Island. And this morning, the Japanese attacked Midway Island. Japan has therefore undertaken a surprise offensive extending through the Pacific area. The facts of yesterday and today speak for themselves. The people of the United States have already formed their opinions and well understand the implications to the very life and safety of our nation. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and the Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense, that always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. I believe that I interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery will never again endanger us. Hostilities exist. There is no blinking at the fact that our people, our territory, and our interests are in grave danger. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounded determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire. Thank you. Over 2,390 men and women were killed or wounded in the Pearl Harbor attack. Of these, 1,177 were sailors killed on the USS Arizona. Many were still in their bunks. Admiral Husband Kimmel was in charge of the Navy, and General Walter Short was in charge of the Army forces at Pearl Harbor. Let me go over a few of the events of the Second World War, starting in the Pacific. There was Wake Island, where a Marine major by the last name of Devereaux fought off several Japanese invasion attempts until he and his men and the construction men that were there also ran out of ammunition. They all died, and so did many Japanese. In the Philippines, General Douglas MacArthur and his second-in-command, General Jonathan Skinny Wainwright, were there. I called General MacArthur home. We could not afford to have a man of his caliber fall into the Japanese hands. Skinny Wainwright stayed. Skinny Wainwright went to a prison camp. The Americans and Filipinos who were captured by the Japanese took part in what has become known as the Bataan Death March, in which the Japanese forced them to walk under hot, arid conditions for many, many miles, with men falling to the side and being shot. But on April 18, 1942, we got some revenge on the Japanese. Jimmy Doolittle and his raiders with B-25 medium bombers were launched from Navy carriers and bombed Japan. The Japanese were shocked and could not figure where these planes came from, because normally you could not launch a B-25 medium army bomber from an aircraft carrier. They captured some of our crews, and one famous crew, when they were questioned, the Japanese wanted to know where they came from. And some of them said, Shangri-La. The Japanese were not happy. At Midway, in June of 1942, the tide of the war changed and turned. We had broken enough of the Japanese code to figure out that they were going to attack Midway Island, and also were going to send forces to the Aleutians in Alaska, but that was a diversion. We weren't too worried about Alaska. But when they got to Midway, we had four aircraft carriers there. They didn't know it. We sank four of their aircraft carriers, which put them out of action. They could not invade. And from that point on, they were on the run in the Pacific. We lost one aircraft carrier. They lost four. There was island hopping in the Pacific. Chester Nimitz, who was an admiral, decided that that was the strategy to use. Instead of attacking every single Japanese stronghold and losing thousands of men and sailors, we would bypass the ones that were too strong, go around them, and let them wither on the vine. They could not get supplies. We cut them off, and we saved men's lives. There was Guadalcanal, Tarawa, Saipan, the Philippines, Okinawa, Iwo Jima, all of these. And against Adolf Hitler, we went into North Africa to fight against Erwin Rommel and his Afrika Corps, with the help of the British, of course. They were there. We then went to Sicily and into Italy and started up that long boot, a tortuous, very difficult drive in the environment of Italy with a mountain chain running down the center. On D-Day, June 6, 1944, we went back to Europe with the British and the Canadians and some French forces. We went to Normandy. We had a tough time on Omaha Beach. Utah Beach was not so bad, but Omaha Beach was. We lost a lot of men. But we succeeded. We went inland and started taking over the French countryside. In December of 1944, we were heading for Germany, and we were in the area known as the Ardennes Forest in Belgium and Luxembourg. What happened then? Right around Christmas was the Battle of the Bulge, where the Germans unleashed all of their forces that they had left on us. And our men were there for rest. They weren't there for a lot of fighting. We had to use cooks and everybody else to fight the Germans. And the weather was terrible. Our airplanes could not interdict the Germans. But then the skies cleared, and George Patton's Third Army came to the rescue, along with the Air Corps, who destroyed the Germans on the ground. It was a mighty victory. How about some names we remember from World War II? General George C. Marshall, Chief of Staff in Washington. General Dwight David Eisenhower, Supreme Commander in Europe. Started out as a 2-star general, and I made him a 4-star general. Admiral William Halsey, known as Bull Halsey. Admiral Ernest King. Admiral Frank Black Jack Fletcher. General Hap Arnold of the United States Army Air Corps. General George Patton. His soldiers called him Old Blood and Guts. They said it was their blood and his guts. The soldiers' general was General Omar Bradley. The men loved him. He was beloved. Admiral Raymond Spruance. Brigadier General Theodore Roosevelt, Jr., a relative of mine who went in at Normandy. About a week later, he died of a heart attack. We also remember a lady named Tokyo Rose who liked to say nasty things about our people in the Pacific. And there was another lady named Axis Annie who liked to say things to our people in Europe, nastiness. The tools of war in the Second World War, the B-17 Flying Fortress, the B-24 Liberator, the B-29 Super Fortress, the B-25 Mitchell Medium Bomber, the B-26 Marauder, the P-40 Curtiss Wright Warhawk, made in Buffalo, New York. The P-38 Lightning, a 2-engine fighter that the Germans called the Fork-Tailed Devil. The P-47 Thunderbolt, the P-51 Mustang. Some consider this to be the best plane of World War II. The C-47 Transport, which is with civilian DC-3. The C-46 Transport, also a Curtiss plane, the Curtiss Commando. The F-4F Navy Wildcat. The F-6F Hellcat, U.S. Navy. The F-4U Corsair, the fighter plane with gull wings. Some also consider this to be one of the best planes of World War II. The Dauntless Dive Bomber, the plane that destroyed the Japanese at Midway. They looked up into the sun, and down came the dive bombers and destroyed them. The M1 Garand Rifle, which is considered by some to be one of the reasons we won World War II. Semi-automatic, I believe 8 rounds. They won't let me use one. The BAR, the Browning Automatic Rifle, heavy but a machine gun you could carry. The Sherman tank, which was a medium tank, the LST, and another thing that maybe helped us to win the war was an item known as the Jeep. Now, I'm going to tell you about a weapon that we probably could not have won the war, or at least it would have been prolonged if we did not have it. And some people are going to say to me, you're talking about the development of the atomic bomb. No. This weapon was even better than the atomic bomb. Do you know what it was? Yes, sir. The American female, the women, the men went off to war, and the women stepped into their jobs in the armaments factories, on the railroads, and every place else. The women took over. If it weren't for the women, the war would have lasted much longer. You should be proud. The American female did her job. You know, it is Christmas time here at the Naval Park. And if you don't realize it, there's two Christmas songs that come directly out of the experience of the Second World War. And you're not aware of it. Do you know what those two Christmas songs are? He says no. You're honest. How about it? I'll be home for Christmas is one of them. Eleanor says, it's I'll be in a home for Christmas. I'll be home for Christmas is the one I was thinking of. And you know what? They know at the White House and at Hyde Park, I like to sing. So I'm going to sing that. If you want to join with me, go ahead. If you want to throw something, make sure it's fresh. I'll be home for Christmas. You can plan on me. Please have snow and mistletoe and presents on the tree. Christmas Eve will find me where I long to be. I'll be home for Christmas, if only in my dreams. I like it. You must think about the lyrics of that song. I'll be home for Christmas, if only in my dreams. The American servicemen and women, wherever they were in the world, were thinking of their families and of Christmas all through the war. Now here on the home front, and we're in Buffalo, and I once was the governor of New York. Do you know? We had rationing. You couldn't go buy just anything. You had ration tickets. Your car had a ration sticker on it for how much gas you could get. There was the OPA, which was the Office of Price Administration. We did not want inflation during the war. There were scrap drives. We needed scrap rubber and metal and a lot of other things. Even fat could be made into munitions. You couldn't get new tires for your car. Matter of fact, you couldn't get a new car. Only the military received new vehicles. and me. Travel was restricted. We had booming industries like Curtis Wright, Bell, Aircraft, others all over the area. Bethlehem Steel was very important, Republic Steel. We had Victory Gardens everywhere. People were growing everything they could to help out. Rosie the Riveter, as was mentioned, was one of the things. And the women could do almost anything a man could do, and in some cases could do it better. Eleanor, during the war, came to me and showed me a book or a catalog from the New York Horticultural Society, because they had named a rose after her called the Eleanor. She was so happy and beaming and smiling and everything, and then all of a sudden she started to scowl. She looked nasty. I said, "Well, what's wrong, Eleanor? What's wrong?" She brought the catalog over to me and said, "You read the description. No good in a bed, but great up against the wall." I laughed too. I thought that was pretty funny. She didn't. She was a tough woman, believe me. I sent her to check on things all over the country because I could not, and I was too busy. There's another Christmas song that comes directly from the Second World War experience. Do you know which one that is? Yes, White Christmas, which came from the movie, I believe, Holiday Inn. Everybody says White Christmas was the movie. No, that was later. That wasn't then. Yes, Holiday Inn was the movie, and there were different stars in there. Bing Crosby was one of them. Danny Kaye was in there. Fred Astaire definitely was in there. They wouldn't let me go in. So, well, let me try that one for you. See if I remember the lyrics. And Buffalo had a white non-Christmas, didn't it? Yes, probably won't even have a white Christmas. Maybe not. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, with every Christmas card I write, may your days be merry and bright. I've got competition. And may all your Christmases be white. I beat him. You know, during the war, politics continued unabated. So we were fighting the Germans and the Japanese. So what? They still didn't like me. Well, some people didn't. There was an election in 1944, and they'd made me run again. I did not want to run for a fourth term, but they said, "You can't leave now with the war coming to a close soon." So I said, all right, I'll run. But I campaigned very little, very little. I defeated the Republican candidate, the governor of New York, Thomas E. Dewey, by 432 electoral votes to 99 electoral votes. They were getting closer. But during the war, petty politics still reared its head. And let me read you a speech, at least part of it, that I gave in Chicago during the war. Well, let's make some simple illustrations that come to mind. For example, although I rubbed my eyes when I read it, we have been told that it was not a Republican depression, but a Democratic depression from which the nation was saved in 1933. That this administration, this one, mine, was responsible for all of the suffering and misery that the history books said that the American people have always thought had been brought about during the 12 ill-fated years when the Republican Party was in power. Now, there is an old and somewhat lugubrious adage which says, never speak of a rope in the house of a man who has been hanged. In the same way, if I were a Republican leader speaking to a mixed audience, the last word in the whole dictionary that I think I would use is that word, depression. These Republican leaders have not been content with attacks on me, or my wife, or my sons. No, not content with that they now include my little dog, Fowler. Well, of course, I don't resent attacks, and my family doesn't resent attacks. But Fowler does resent them. You know, Fowler is a Scotty. And being a Scotty, as soon as he learned that the Republican fiction writers in Congress and out had concocted a story that I had left him behind on the Aleutian Islands and had sent a destroyer back to find him at a cost to the American taxpayer of $2, $3, $8, or $20 million, his Scotch soul was furious. He has not been the same dog since. I am accustomed to hearing malicious statements about myself, such as that old worm-eaten chestnut, that I have represented myself as indispensable. But I think I have a right to resent, to object to libelous statements about my dog. Thank you. As the war was drawing to an end in February of 1945, I met with Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin at Yalta in the Russian Crimea to discuss a possible unconditional surrender policy in regard to Germany. By the time of my return from Yalta, I was clearly in failing health. Franklin D. Roosevelt died of a cerebral hemorrhage while at Warm Springs, Georgia, on April 12th, 1945, at the age of 63. Vice President Harry S. Truman was sworn in as president. the route of the train that was bearing FDR's body back from Georgia to Washington was lined with millions of mourners, many in tears. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was laid to rest at his beloved estate, Springwood, which is in Hyde Park, New York, on the Hudson. And now, to conclude this program, I'd like to explain the history of a patriotic song. Back when the war clouds were gathering over Europe for World War I, the First World War, the United States Army, in order to recruit people for that conflict, decided that they would stage a Broadway show. So they did put a show on with the fabulous, memorable name of Yip Yip Ya Plank. I'd always remember that. And no, I'm not Roosevelt anymore. So a young songwriter from New York wrote up a patriotic song, and he gave it to the directors of this musical. They looked it over, and everybody looked it over and said, uh-uh, not enough zip, no zing. He took it back and threw it in a drawer. And when the war clouds gathered again over Europe prior to World War II, he took the song out and gave it to a Southern belle. And she sang that song and made it famous. And her name was Kate Smith. So what I'd like to do now is sing the stanza to that song. Most of you don't know the stanza to that song. I do. I'll sing it, and then you can come in. And if you want to stand then, that's fine. Or stand right away. You'll know this song, but you're used to singing the chorus. You don't sing the stanza normally that precedes it. So I'll sing that, and then you come in. You too. While the dark clouds gather far across the sea, let us pledge allegiance in a land that's free. Let us raise our voices to a land so fair. Let us raise our voices in a solemn prayer. God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with a light from above. From the mountains to the prairies to the oceans white with foam, God bless America, my home, sweet home. God bless America, my home, sweet home. This gentleman here actually participated in World War II, which means he is not a teenager. Can you tell us your age?
96.
He's only 96. So, and what service were you in?
I was in the Army with the 1st Red Button
Big red one, okay. Yes, very good. In Europe?
In Europe, all through Germany.
All through Germany, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Which general was your commanding general?
General Eisenhower.
Oh, I mean below him.
Fat.
Oh, George.
Blood and guts.
Yeah, old blood and guts. He wasn't afraid to go up to the front either. No. Do you have any questions? If you have any questions, and nobody threw anything either, so it was good. We've got some young people here that maybe learned something today. At least I hope they did. Yeah. Set? Oh, we got another speaker. Okay. Thank you very much for attending this ceremony.
You can stay up there and get the headphones, please.
Okay. All right. Okay. Yeah. All right.
You can be seated, please. Albert, it's a rare opportunity that we can get someone to impersonate a historical figure. And I know for the generation that we have in front of me here from Akron, it might be that 9/11 has more meaning to you and your generation. But Pearl Harbor was the event that preceded 9/11 that affected an entire country and an entire world. So maybe some of the older folks in the room, certainly Dr. Long, who has had firsthand experience, realizes how that changed the world. And we're hoping that you continue to look into your studies, read about it, see movies about it, and educate yourselves about the sacrifices that were made. I'm going to call upon another staff member now who's going to elaborate on the comments of Albert McFadden, and that is our Director of Education, Stephen Tedesco. Stephen.
So earlier this year, we watched as a crisis unfolded here at the Buffalo Naval Park. But the community came together to help us save the Sullivans. And it was in this same way that the Sullivan brothers helped the community as well. As with many stories from World War II, the Sullivan story begins at Pearl Harbor. The attack on Pearl Harbor killed 2,403 U.S. personnel, including sailors, soldiers, and civilians. Half of those who perished at Pearl Harbor were on the USS Arizona. 38 sets of brothers were aboard the USS Arizona. The sinking of the Arizona killed 23 sets of those brothers, as well as a father and a son. Of the 38, one set of brothers were William and Maston Ball. Maston would survive the attack on Pearl Harbor, but William, who was known as Bill, would perish on that infamous day. The Ball brothers lived in Fredericksburg, Iowa, 30 miles north of Waterloo. Bill came to Waterloo most Thursdays to attend dances at Electric Park, where he was dancing partners with Genevieve Sullivan. He would also play baseball with the locals, which included the Sullivan brothers. This, among a love for their country, inspired the Sullivan brothers to enlist in the Navy and fight in World War II. Less than 1 year later, the Sullivan brothers would share the same fate as William. After the events at Pearl Harbor, communities across this nation came together to support our country and our freedom. Men and women left their homes, some of them for the last time, to protect those communities and their country. To quote President Barack Obama, "We the people recognize that we have responsibilities as well as rights, that our destinies are bound together, that a freedom which only asks what's in it for me, a freedom without a commitment to others, a freedom without love or charity or duty or patriotism, is unworthy of our founding ideals and those who died in their defense." So did anybody have any questions for President Roosevelt?
Yes, I do. Why did it take so long for the Time magazine, New York News, or the New York Post back then, why did it take so long to report on World War II?
I have no idea. The military, in order to keep the enemy many times from getting valuable information that they would like to have, would try to manage the news, the releases,
so that it would not give aid and comfort to the enemy, be it the Germans or the Japanese. And of course, the communications in those days were slower than they are today. I don't know that the people are slower, but the communications were. Yeah, definitely. They didn't. Now it's instant communications. If something happens, everybody knows it right away on the computer. Fast. Everything that's going on in the Ukraine is reported on the nightly news. They couldn't do that in World War II. It was impossible. But anyway. Yes. Yes.
If FDR maintained his presidency and not passed away, do you feel that he would have used Vietnam bombs?
Yes. Yeah. That decision had more or less been made. The interesting part is, and these young people will want to know this, Harry Truman, who was the president when I was born, I would have been born under FDR, except that, of course, he passed away. Harry Truman, who was the vice president under FDR for his fourth term, did not even know that we were developing an atomic bomb. It was a secret even to him. He wasn't aware. Some military people knew, obviously, and some others, but Harry Truman did not. And the day Roosevelt died, or close by, they had to pull him aside and brief him on the development of the atomic bomb, which was known as the, you know, what they call that? The Manhattan Project, right. It was the Manhattan Project. So he didn't know anything about it. He was very surprised. He had to make the decision, because he was president. He probably did the right thing. We would have lost thousands of people trying to invade the Japanese mainland, and the Navy would have lost who knows how many ships, because the Japanese by that point were using just kamikazes. And you know what a kamikaze was? People didn't even know how to fly. They just showed them, taught them how to get the plane off the ground and to go run it into a ship. That was it. Now that's a very effective tool, I have to admit it. But you lose a lot of people and a lot of equipment that way. So, but that's saved us from invading and having all of these things killing our people on the beach. So he probably, in the long run, it saved lives. It wasn't a nice thing, but war by its nature is not nice. Some people think it's supposed to be nice, that you're supposed to play by certain rules. They do sometimes, but they don't always. Hitler certainly didn't always play by the rules, and the Japanese did not. So, anyway, Harry Truman was the one that ended up behind the eight ball. And he was, as they say, he was president when I was born. So. Any others? By the way, Franklin D. Roosevelt and Eleanor are both buried in the Rose Garden at Hyde Park, New York. They are there. I don't know if the dog Fala's there, though, but he could be. North of Hyde Park, there's a Episcopal church where the rest of the Roosevelt family is buried. I've been there. One area of the cemetery is all Roosevelt's, the entire area. Franklin was part of what was known as the Roosevelts of Hyde Park. Teddy Roosevelt, and you're aware of Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt was from the family of the Roosevelts from Oyster Bay on Long Island. So there were two different parts of the family. And of course, Franklin married his distant cousin, Eleanor, who was a Roosevelt, but she was a distant cousin, so by law, they could get married. I know people have asked me, how could he marry his cousin-in-law? She was a distant cousin, it was allowed. They kept the same last name.
Can we have another hand for Albert McFadden? As we kind of wrap things up here, I'd just like to thank a number of people. First of all, our mission, every organization like a nonprofit has a mission statement. Our mission statement can be boiled down to four words: honor, educate, inspire, and preserve. We want to honor veterans and active military. We want to educate the public about the sacrifices of those that serve, including the ones on the home front, like we had talked earlier, of what the role was of the women during World War II. We want to inspire a generation for a sense of patriotism and an appreciation for the rights and freedoms that our veterans fought so hard to attain. And lastly, to preserve the artifacts, the military artifacts that have been entrusted to our care. So with that, I would like all those veterans to please stand up and be recognized for your role. Thank you. I want to thank Fred Marazita for the invocation and benediction. I'm going to call him back up here in a minute. I want to thank all the docents. The docents are the people that you have seen in uniform with the Naval Park caps on. They give tours of the ships, and I am understanding that you will be getting a tour of the ships afterwards, so I'm excited that you'll have that opportunity. Mr. George Miller, for singing our national anthem. The Francis J. Donovan American Legion Post, for doing the Rifle Brigade and the Bugle. And our special guest, obviously, Albert McFadden. We also have our staff members who did a great job in pulling this educational forum together. Courtney Speckman and Stephen Tedesco. Thank you. And the gentleman in the vest, who might look a little bit different than the other docents who are here, are from the sub-base, vets, sub-veterans, Buffalo base. And their commander is Fritz Marazita. So Fred, would you please come up here? We began in prayer. Let's end in prayer. Please stand.
I just have two things to say before I get to the benediction. One of the tools of war, sir, that you missed were the submarines of the Pacific.
You are correct.
Who were instrumental in our victory in the Pacific.
Right. They devastated the Japanese merchant marine completely.
At the loss of 52 submarines and 3,500 men, but they sank more ships in tonnage than any other members of the Navy, any other ships. And we have a tradition as submarine veterans. I wish you were sitting down so you could stand up. But we have a tradition at the beginning of every one of our meetings to recognize every World War II veteran. So if we could give our World War II veteran another round of applause. Thank you, sir, for your service. And I didn't have to learn German. Please uncover. We'll end with the prayer given by Captain Roland W. Falk, CHC USN, prior to the start of the September 2nd, 1945 surrender ceremony aboard USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay. Eternal God, Father of all living, we offer our sincere prayer of thanksgiving to Thee on this day, which we now dedicate to peace among the nations, remembering another Sabbath that was desecrated by the beginning of this brutal war. We are thankful that those who have loved peace have been rewarded with victory over those who have loved war. May it ever be so. On this day of deliverance, we pray for those who, through long years, have been imprisoned, destitute, sick, and forsaken. Heal their bodies and their spirits, O God, for their wounds are grievous and sharp and deep. May the scars which they bear remind us that victory is not bought without cost and peace is not without price. May we never forget those who have paid the cost of our victory and our peace. On this day of surrender, we turn hopefully from war to peace, from destroying to building, from killing to saving. But peace without justice, we know, is hopeless, and justice without mercy thou wilt surely despise. Help us therefore, O God, to do justice and to love mercy and to walk humbly before thee. We pray for thy servant, the President of the United States, and for all the leaders of all lands, that they may be endowed with wisdom sufficient for their great tasks. Grant unto the people of the earth knowledge of thee with courage and faith to abide with the shelter of thy sovereign law. Amen.
I'm going to conclude this ceremony, but before I do, we are a nonprofit organization, which means we are run by a board of directors. We have one of our directors here, Mr. Doug Stevens. Give a yell. John Radins. Is John Radins still here as well? I thought he was back there, but that's okay. And of course, I'm going to give a special shout out to the students here. It's great to see you. I'm so pleased that you took the time out of your day to be here to share this experience with veterans, especially the rare opportunity of a World War II veteran. Learn from today, take it back, share with your fellow students. This ceremony is concluded. God bless you all, and God bless America.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL Draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.